Tantal Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Potion for Passion by Elizabeth Kezian, narrated by Carmen Rose. Chapter 1. August, 1805. The Isle of Portland, England. Miss Flora Hartington rarely had the chance to admire a handsome man openly, so she was making the most of it. Her position at the back of the crowd on East Town's Village Green gave her an excellent view of Dr. L.E. Campaign, an itinerant physician touting his remedies from his portable wooden stage. Campaign, who some of the locals unkindly called a quack doctor, was no stranger to her. The previous year, Flora had purchased bottles of his universal remedy, his revitalizing tonic, and his certain cure for the tertian ague, amongst many others. She was so certain his cures worked that she'd even corresponded with the man, ordering items via the local carrier. Typically, this had earned her a sharp rebuke from her shrewish older sister, Lucinda. Flora was ashamed to admit she wasn't missing Lucinda at all. When Flora's niece Charlotte married the Earl of Beckport, Lucinda had moved into the dower house at Beckport Park so she could keep an eye on her daughter. This meant Flora had her small cottage to herself again. Alas, the longed-for freedom from disapproval had not materialized. Apparently the aunt-in-law of an earl was expected to behave with an even greater propriety than the aunt-in-law of a commoner. Thus Flora's sister had set the Reverend Daniel and his family as spies to watch over her, lest she do something terrible. Which was somewhat ironic, considering Lucinda's own shady past. A past so shady, in fact, that Lucinda and Charlotte had had to change their surname. Luckily, the least able of said spies, the Reverend's daughter Thea, was on duty today. The girl had lingered to listen to a ballad singer at the crossroads, giving Flora a few welcome moments to herself. What would society say if they knew how Flora's heart beat faster at the sight of Dr. Campaign's covered wagon, with its gaily painted magical symbols and evil eyes? She had fallen ever so slightly in love with him last year, when he'd helped the family, and the Earl of Beckport, out of some awkward situations. But then, as the autumn leaves began to fall, the self-proclaimed healer had vanished, not just from Portland, but from the entire region. Some said it was to avoid moneylenders, others that he'd been involved with various women on his travels, and had become a person of interest to some powerful aristocratic husbands. Flora could see how quickly such entanglements might happen. A sigh escaped her, as she gazed in mute admiration at the prime specimen of manhood on the stage. The quack doctor had always reminded her a little of Frank. Frank Mullen, the only man she'd ever truly loved, whose ship had gone down 4 years ago with all hands. Her dead fiancé had sported the same dark eyes, eyebrows, and sun-browned skin as Campaign. The doctor, however, wore no officer's powdered wig, as Frank had. He wore what God had given him. His own thick, glossy hair, black as a raven's wing, tied at the nape of his neck. His deep, resonant voice was perfect for the stage. Maybe he'd once been an actor. Such skills would be useful in convincing his audience of the power of his remedies. Despite the agonizing reminder of Frank, Flora couldn't look away. Nor could she help speculating on how such a young, good-looking, and well-spoken man had come to be an itinerant healer. He couldn't be more than 28, surely, barely older than herself. His astonishingly white teeth showed to good effect when he grinned.
"Now this, ladies and gentlemen," he boomed, "is as efficacious a remedy for nervousness as you'll find in all of Europe. Those great lords and ladies on the other side of the channel swore by it in their time of trouble. Indeed, 'tis well known that Queen Marie Antoinette herself sipped it from a silver teaspoon on her way to meet with Madame Guillotine." Flora smiled knowingly. Campaign would have been a mere youth at the time, hardly likely to be supplying the French royal family with nostrums. She looked around, enjoying the crowd's reaction to this ludicrous claim. But when her gaze returned to the stage, she found the man was looking straight at her. Her equanimity tottered, then collapsed. Did he remember her from last year? Presumably, as she'd been one of his best customers. But ever since Frank's death 4 years ago, she'd disappeared into a twilight world, neither craving nor expecting the attention of any man. The likelihood of some gentleman seeing her as a potential wife and mother at the age of 27 was slim. Not even her slight connection to an earl could make up for her unexceptional looks and mouse-coloured hair. Even so, no gentlewoman like herself should welcome an enticing glance from an itinerant. Even if he did have a reputation as a superlative lover. Her cheeks pinked. Lucinda had told her time and again not to listen to gossip, and not involve herself in the affairs of lesser folk, except when bringing them charity, of course. Dr. L.E. Campaign didn't look like a man in need of charity. "Do you feel fatigued?" he asked his listeners. "Do you feel as if the sky is made of lead and weighing you down? Does every conversation feel like a battlefield?" Yes, every conversation did feel like a battlefield. She just couldn't shake off her spies. She knew that if she put a foot wrong, her misdemeanor would be reported back to her sister post-haste. Flora still felt just as stifled as she had when Lucinda and Charlotte had invaded her tiny cottage in the neighboring village of Fortune's Well and taken over her life. There was just one hope of escape, which was to move away altogether. She could set up a hat shop. Designing and trimming bonnets was the only skill she had to offer the world, and she loved doing it. Not even her stodgy sister's disapproval could dent her enthusiasm for millinery. Flora had secretly saved up enough to go into partnership, so she could learn how to actually make bonnets. And she had her eye on a milliner's, right here in East Town. A partnership wasn't her ultimate ambition, but it would be a step in the right direction, and surely millinery was a respectable enough profession for someone whose niece had married an earl. There was another advantage to this plan. East Town was a bracing distance from Fortune's Well, and would severely reduce the ability of the Daniel family to spy on her. Admittedly, they had a carriage, but it was a bother and expensive, so they rarely used it. Only young Thea would have the energy to walk regularly to East Town, but Flora was fairly certain she'd soon tire of the task of shadowing a respectable spinster, which reminded her. Flora looked around, but Thea was still entranced by the balladeer. Good. And now that Campaign had cast his mesmeric gaze elsewhere, Flora could allow herself the deliciously wicked treat of admiring him once more. What a square, determined jaw he had, and such firm but generous lips. His slim, muscular figure exhibited the steely strength of a man living an active life on the open road. Life on the open road! How terrifying that sounded. Such an existence would be full of troubles and worries, moving from town to town, running the gauntlet of footpads and highwaymen, meeting and trying to impress strangers every day to make one's living. It must be exhausting. Glory be! He was looking directly at her again. The dark slashes of his eyebrows raised in inquiry. She quivered and swallowed hard, then nodded, though totally unaware of what he'd asked. For a brief moment she feared it might have been something utterly improper. What foolishness! How could she imagine he had any particular interest in her? He'd styled himself to appeal to all females in the audience, cultivating a wild look and an air of danger to tickle their fancy and fire their imaginations. By making eye contact and flirting with every woman in the crowd, he'd make more sales. Having scolded herself to stop wool gathering and listen properly, she had a stroke of brilliance. Dr. Ellie Campaign's nerve tonic was exactly what she needed, the perfect antidote to the effect he had on her. And it might also ease the tension she suffered while under the watchful eye of the Daniels. But how embarrassing to own up to having a nervous disposition in front of all these people. Some folk she knew wore their ailments like badges of honour, proud to announce their suffering to the rest of the world, but not Flora. Besides which, Lucinda would use Flora's head for a pincushion if she found out she'd bought a quack remedy so publicly. She glanced around, but no one was spying on her. She must do it. She must buy some. Her scalp prickled at the thought of her own daring. Campaign's voice broke in on her thoughts. "Don't look so crestfallen, madam," he advised. "It's within my power to make you a particular offer today. As I have excess stock, I can provide, for this afternoon only, a second bottle of this miraculous nerve tonic for just a shilling. Surely that must bring a smile to your pretty lips." She suddenly realized she was surrounded by silence, and that all heads were turned in her direction. Madam, yes. The madam with the delightfully silky curls. I'm addressing you. No need to be shy. Everyone here will agree you can't afford to miss this opportunity. Her face heated up like a boiled lobster, and she wanted the ground to open up and swallow her. But his choice of words shot through her head and bounced back and forth, flattering and terrifying at the same time. Pretty lips. Silky curls. He couldn't mean that. He was just being a good salesman. And how could he tell she was considering the nerve tonic? Was he a magician, as well as a self-styled physician?
"Go on, Miss Hartington," said a voice beside her. "At only a shilling for the second bottle, I'm sorely tempted myself."
The widow Sally Matthews, proprietress of Matthews Milliners, the very shop in which Flora hoped for a partnership, smiled at her encouragingly.
"If you buy some," Sally added, "I'll get some too. I just don't want to be first to step forward."
Flora didn't want to step forward at all. But with everyone looking at her, she'd feel as much a fool if she did, as she would if she didn't.
"Let's go up together," she whispered to Sally, "if you insist."
Sally nodded, and the doctor clapped his hands as they jostled their way through the crowd. "Ah, you must be my lucky charm, madam," he enthused at Flora, leaping lightly down from the stage. "For you bring with you a second customer. Thank you." Grateful that her bonnet hid her blushes, Flora accepted the two bottles of nerve tonic in trembling fingers and bestowed them immediately in her reticule. Sally smiled broadly, looking at the crowd over her shoulder as she handed over her shillings. East Town's hat and bonnet maker and purveyor of decorative trimmings was loving the attention. Indeed, no one observing Sally's behaviour could imagine she needed a nerve tonic. Flora caught a significant look passing between the doctor and the milliner before Sally turned to face the crowd, announcing,
"I'll take this remedy dutifully for the whole week. I promise anyone who comes into my establishment during that time will be given a free sample until the first bottle is quite empty. My regular customers can try 2 teaspoonsful if they wish. I declare, it's quite in my own interest. I don't want anyone to feel nervous about buying a bonnet from me."
A surge of laughter rippled through the assembled watchers, and Sally marched off looking pleased with herself. Flora was left standing in front of the crowd, flushed and awkward, and unable to shake the impression that she'd just been used, and shown herself a gullible fool in front of everyone. If Lucinda ever found out, she'd have a field day. Chapter 2. "Forgive me, Miss Hartington," an amused voice whispered in Flora's ear. "I wasn't expecting that. I think we've both been made use of as an advertisement for hats. To make amends, please accept a free bottle of Dr. Ellie Campaign's Ethiopian Hair Tonic. It will save you hours of wrestling with the curling tongs to aid your hair's natural curl." Flora felt a shock of heat when Campaign's fingers brushed hers as he slipped the small bottle into her hand. Startled, she gazed up into a pair of eyes, twinkling with humour, with irises so dark they were almost as black as the pupils. His smiling mouth was close enough for his breath to feather her cheek. She detected a smell of clove oil, evocative of fascinating foreign realms she'd only ever read about in journals. The man exuded an air of mystery, which drew her in, making her hold his gaze much longer than she should, much longer than was proper. Pulling free of that hypnotic look, she stammered her thanks and retreated to the back of the crowd. As soon as she felt herself no longer the focus of everyone's attention, she looked around for Thea. Oh no. Miss Dorothea Daniel had been joined by her parents, and all three were headed straight toward Flora.
"Miss Hartington,"
Mrs. Daniel greeted her crisply, while Thea looked sheepish.
"I'm disappointed to see that you're not with my daughter. I'd hoped you would act as her chaperone when she offered to accompany you."
Flora almost snorted at this. They both knew well enough who was supposed to be chaperoning whom, though no one had yet dared say it openly. Mrs. Daniel continued,
"What if my Dorothea were to find herself wandering alone on the heath, where footpads and highwaymen lurk? What if she were to get lost in the back streets, where off-duty soldiers slouch around in taverns? It doesn't bear thinking about."
The temptation to say it would be Thea's own fault if she did such things was resisted.
"I can assure you, Flora said, wishing she'd had time to take a sip of the nerve tonic, "that I have barely taken my eye off her. There's no need for alarm." Besides which, the fort with its soldiers was miles away, as was the heath. Mrs. Daniel's ability to make a mountain out of a molehill was second to none. "Very well, then," huffed the other woman, shooting a look at her husband. "I can see there's no harm done. But it's time to leave for Fortune's Well now. Your sister tells me you always visit the Embrys on a Thursday." Flora repressed a shudder, as she did whenever that particular family was mentioned. Her last experience with the Embrys had not been one of her finest moments. "Well, I used to," she muttered, "but not any more." Until her sister and niece had joined Flora in the cottage left to her by Frank, she'd been more than happy to be charitable by knitting socks for sailors with a small group of friends around the tea table. However, Lucinda, keen to make her mark in Fortune's Well society, was full of zeal for good causes and insisted they all take succor directly into the homes of the needy and the sick. Flora had been browbeaten into visiting the Embrys, a family of wild motherless children watched over by their grizzled drunkard of a father. One particular visit, involving flea bites, child vomit, an attempted kiss from Mr. Embry, had sent Flora scurrying for the door, vowing never to enter that horrid hovel again. Declaring her a coward, Lucinda had undertaken the task of visiting the Embrys herself. She'd scrubbed the children to within an inch of their lives, bombarded Mr. Embry with so much prune juice he no longer had any stomach for drink, and given out helpful advice about the children's diet, as well as further prune juice, which would prevent them from ever being sick again. This episode had the effect, no doubt intended, of making Flora feel a failure. But despite her sister's assurances that all was now resolved, she never offered to revisit the Embrys. Now it looked as if her hand might be forced. "Miss Hartington, madam!" She was shaken from her reverie by Campaign's voice. As one, she and her companions looked in the direction of the stage. "You've forgotten your change." The nostrum seller waved her forward. Blushing furiously, she went, but not before seeing a look of utter distaste cross Mrs. Daniel's features. "What change?" she whispered, as soon as she reached the stage.
"There is none," he whispered back. "But you looked as if you needed rescuing."
"Not at all," she answered primly, pretending to take a coin from his hand. "They're my friends."
"Enemies, more like," he said, staring at the Daniels through a gap in the crowd. "The lady looks as if she's been sucking lemons." There was no denying that. But how wicked of him to mention it. Flora hid her smile and replied,
"I fear the Reverend and his wife don't much approve of itinerant medicine men."
"That would explain why I've never seen them at any of my shows. A pity, as I'm sure my cure for constipation would benefit the lady greatly." Flora chuckled. Anything that improved Mrs. Daniel's acerbic temperament would be most welcome.
"Perhaps I should buy her some as a gift," she suggested.
"I'll give you some for that very purpose, no charge," he added with a wink. "You have been a stalwart customer in the past, and I must say, you're looking very well." Flora's mind was demanding to know how Campaign came to have such a cultured accent, and the ability to speak just like a gentleman, a question that had greatly taxed her last year. Her body, on the other hand, was trying to make sense of its response to that wink. Her knees were particularly affected. When he handed her a corked bottle with another wink, her heart started misbehaving too, so by the time she tucked the medicine into her reticule and rejoined the Daniels, she felt like a quivering wreck.
"Well, really," uttered Mrs. Daniel with a gasp of outrage. "That man has made a spectacle of you. I'd have stopped you going up there, had I thought of it. Mrs. Austin would never approve of you speaking to such a fellow. And yet my sister doesn't mind me speaking to Mr. Embry. Is not a travelling physician more respectable than a drunkard?"
Flora surprised herself. It was, of course, high time she stood up to Lucinda and to Mrs. Daniel, and she'd never expected it to be in defence of Dr. Campaign. As she watched that lady suck in what looked to be a pre-tirade breath, she quickly reached for the nerve tonic, covered over the label, and took a sip. Surprise furrowed her brow. Did it taste of brandy?
"What's that?" Thea asked. "A remedy for those who suffer sneezing fits," Flora fibbed, not wanting to draw attention to her anxious disposition. She took another sip. The taste was not unpleasant, with the brandy masking the bitterness of whatever herbs were in the mixture. Unfortunately, I can't remember what the dose was meant to be. She took another somewhat bigger sip, then corked the bottle and tucked it away.
What would your sister say if you poisoned yourself?
Mrs. Daniel said crossly. It wouldn't matter, thought Flora, because I'd be too ill to care.
I must agree, said Reverend Daniel. And even if some of these remedies work, their cost is extortionate. People should stick to tried and tested remedies. Then they'd have money left on a Sunday for the collection.
Flora bit her lip. If she were very unlucky, the Reverend would devote his next sermon to lambasting those who squandered their coin on unsanctioned medicines. Thea took her arm.
It must be nearly time for luncheon, the young woman said. Had we not better be getting home?
That sounded like a splendid idea, or it would be, if Flora didn't have to walk all the way to Fortune's Well in the company of the Daniels. It was kind of campaign to try to rescue her, but, in effect, it just made things worse. She now had so many bottles in her reticule it clinked at every step, prompting the Reverend to offer to carry them in his pockets for her. He'd relieved her of her reticule before she had time to blink and began placing the bottles in his coat. This action allowed Mrs. Daniel to read the labels, which meant Lucinda would soon know every detail of what Flora had been buying, and that she'd lied about the nerve tonic. Oh, how desperately she longed to escape her Daniel family spies. They were making her life a complete misery. When Mrs. Daniel scoffed at the free hair tonic would probably make Flora's hair fall out, she very nearly lost her temper.
I have every intention of using it this afternoon, she announced stiffly. You'll see the results on the morrow. I'm confident you'll be pleasantly surprised.
True to her vow, the moment the Daniels deposited her at the front door of the cottage, she went upstairs to try out the hair tonic. But half an hour later, when she looked at her freshly washed hair in her tiny mirror, she almost expired on the spot. Mrs. Daniel was right, after all. It was an absolute disaster. Chapter 3. Dr. Lawrence E. Campaign, as he now styled himself, sat in a dark corner of the George Inn, with a guttering candle in front of him and a salt-glazed ale tankard by his left hand. His eyes flicked between the two books he was comparing. Then he dipped his pen and began writing in his notebook, occasionally pausing for a meditative mouthful of ale. Nicholas Culpepper's book advised lesser celandine, more commonly known as pilewort for treating piles, but the Thomas Graham tome recommended brimstone with a lenitive electuary. Lawrence smiled to himself. Why not combine both treatments in an ointment with rose oil to improve the smell? The yellow sulphur would give good colour. Customers liked colour. He'd have to make a stop at Verwood next time he was in Hampshire and get some new pots made. It would be pointless trying to sell the remedy openly from his wagon, for who'd want to announce publicly that they had hemorrhoids? No, he'd just have an advertisement printed, listing the new pile ointment among his regular stock, and people would come to him privately for it. He chewed on the end of his finger and stared up at the ceiling. Wouldn't it be marvellous if he could sell his potions from one of the shops in each place he visited? It would make the wagon a good deal lighter and create more space for other things. But could he trust the shopkeepers to make a tally of what they'd sold and keep his money safe until he returned to claim it? No, it was far too risky. There were no honest retailers anymore. Better to carry on as he was, just so long as he didn't get caught. So what to call the new nostrum? Dr. Ellie Campaign's instant power remover. No one could make a better claim than that. Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out a slender leather-bound book and leafed through its pages. Which astrological sign governed the anus? If he could contrive a label with that symbol, or use a picture of the pilewort plant, it would make his remedy less embarrassing to buy. His musings were suddenly interrupted by the arrival of the George Inn's landlord, Ransom.
Campaign, there is a woman lurking by your wagon. Your dog's barking fit to burst, but the lady won't go. He scowled. I can't have my customers disturbed like this.
Lawrence kept his expression carefully polite. He knew, though the fellow had never said as much, that the landlord detested itinerants of any kind,
and believed them all to be thieves or cutthroats. Since Lawrence had been brought up by a family of itinerant agricultural labourers, who were so poorly paid they had no qualms about stealing, he understood such prejudice. In Ransom's case, the bias had dissolved relatively quickly when Lawrence had pulled out his satisfyingly fat purse. The landlord didn't need to know the bulk of the contents was spent lead-shot, hammered flat.
"Thank you for telling me. Have this lot taken up to my room, will you?"
Lawrence said, indicating his books and writing materials.
"I'll deal with my customer and be back directly."
As he shouldered himself into his coat, he again pondered the wisdom of leaving only his border collie, Charlie, to guard his precious stock. Yet if he'd done any more than that to protect his wagon, surely it would have excited suspicion. Had he made a mistake by bespeaking himself a room and not sleeping in the wagon as usual? But damn it, every roaming man needed a bit of comfort from time to time, a decent meal, and a good bed. Why risk his neck for coin if he didn't have an occasional luxury? There'd still be enough saved up by the end of the year to sail for America, if everything went to plan. He'd been doing a brisk trade on the Isle of Portland since the soldiers were billeted here. Their medical needs, particularly those of an intimate kind, were legion, which was just as well. Passage to America was costly and could take as long as 3 months in foul weather. But go he must, for the sake of Tom Capstone's troop, the players who'd taken him in when, at the age of 12, he'd escaped his adoptive parents. As always, the memory hurt. As always, it stiffened his resolve to take his knowledge of herb lore and medicine to America, to crush the hideous disease which had killed his friends. It still beggared belief that all but one of them had succumbed to the massive yellow fever epidemic of 1803, shortly after reaching American soil. He should be grateful, he supposed, that he hadn't gone with them. He'd planned to, but had changed his mind at the last moment. Guilt still assailed him. If he had gone and taken his remedies with him, he might have been able to save them. As the potboy scurried over to clear the table of his precious books, Lawrence shook away his dismal thoughts, swigged back what remained of his ale, and strode through the smoky taproom toward the door. Charlie's barking assaulted his ears the instant he stepped out into the inn's courtyard. Other village mutts were already responding, shattering the peace of the cloudless golden evening. It wouldn't be long before people came out of their houses with sticks to beat the dog and threaten its master. "Here, boy." As soon as he reached his wagon, he removed the ham bone from a pocket in the canvas awning and offered it to Charlie. The dog accepted it greedily and busied himself snuffling and chewing while Lawrence looked around for his customer. Ah, there she was. A lady with an excellent figure and bearing. She wore the inevitable veil to hide her face, and her hair was entirely hidden by her deep bonnet. He'd wager a guinea she was after a love potion or a cure for something embarrassing. She might even be looking for a remedy for the fact that her husband didn't bed her any more. Surely that couldn't be the case with this woman, not with a figure like that. Giving Charlie a reassuring pat on the head, he unleashed the smile that always made women give him a second glance, and often a third, and stepped toward her. Never having known the smile to fail, he was therefore astounded when the woman stiffened at the sight of him, then burst into noisy, angry tears. Chapter 4. "Mom, please, calm yourself. How can I help you?" The words screaming around inside Flora's head at that moment were unrepeatable, and the urge to strike Campaign's suavely smiling face intense, but good breeding stayed her hand. She'd already shocked herself with the tears and was struggling to bring her emotions under control.
"You, sir, are a cheat and a liar," she exclaimed, jabbing a finger at him. "That hair tonic you gave me, oh, I can't bring myself to say it. Yes, I can. I'm utterly, utterly ruined. You've made me a laughing stock."
The smile vanished, and the doctor stared at her intently. After a moment, he said,
"Is that my best customer, Miss Hartington, hiding her pretty face behind a veil?"
She nodded. She had been a good customer, because until now, everything she'd bought from him had worked.
"What exactly has happened to upset you so?" he asked.
"I can't tell you here," she whispered. I need somewhere private to show you.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?